So as you may have heard from my bio, I don't actually work directly on all the issues I'll be talking about today. I'm trying to stand in for some colleagues who couldn't make it, and I seem to have broken the thing. Okay, good. I hope you'll find this interesting. In the process of researching and talking to my colleagues, I actually found it really fascinating. So I want to talk a little bit about this program of work that's part of our work within Oxfam, which is on extractive industries, and really trying to link it to some of the public health concerns that I think would be useful for us to talk about today. I have no relationships to disclose. Being in New Orleans of all places, I think the impact, the public health impact of extractive industries is abundantly clear. There was a really interesting report put out by the World Health Organization a couple of years ago called Managing the Public Health Impacts of Natural Resource Extracting Activities. It's a really long report. It goes through a lot of different issues. I think it was actually kind of a discussion paper more than anything, sort of very concrete. But I'd recommend you have a look at it if you're interested. I've tried to draw some of the interesting points from it into this presentation. But I'll talk a little bit about that, and then I'll talk as well about some of the work that we're doing in a couple of case studies. So why does Oxfam, a humanitarian and human rights and development organization, work on extractive industries to begin with? Well, we found that extractive industry activity causes direct impact on poor communities, many of whom we work with around the world. We work in around 92 countries. Some of those impacts include health, environmental degradation, human rights violations, conflict, displacement. A lot of land grabs are a big part of extractive industries. There's a really big power as well as information imbalance between communities, governments, and companies, and you often see that governments are working very closely with companies, which come in with just massive resources and really override democratic processes in countries. At the same time, more and more, it was good to hear Dr. Donahue's mention of the aid statistics. One thing that I find particularly interesting as well in that is, so 25% is the amount of aid people think we give, less than 1% is the amount we actually give. When people were asked how much should we be giving, they tend to say 8 to 10%, so hugely higher than we're actually giving. But nevertheless, there's a real shift in aid practices towards the potential for trade and that kind of economic growth to create solutions to poverty and to create development. So that means that there's actually less desire to give aid, even though, as has just been pointed out, that aid is often incredibly tied to U.S. interests, particularly in the case of food aid, farming interests. But as there's this move to trade away from aid, minerals are the number one export of many poor countries. So the extractive industry focus is incredibly important in terms of what kinds of development outcomes those countries will have. And then finally, working on extractive industries from the perspective that we do is a means of fighting poverty and also empowering poor communities around the world. So just a little bit about the program goal of our area of work. We're seeking to ensure that oil, gas, and mining projects respect the rights of citizens and contribute to poverty reduction as part of an environmentally and socially responsible form of development. Just a few disclosures on our ways of working. Oxfam America does not accept any money from the U.S. government in order to preserve our independence. We also do not accept any money from extractive industry companies. We're not against or for extractive industries in principle. We recognize that they exist. And so we're working to try to work with communities that are affected by extractive industries, supporting bottom-up, local-to-global influencing, sometimes using insider strategies, sometimes using outsider strategies. Some of those insider strategies might include buying very small numbers of shares in companies to enable us to be at investor meetings, etc., to try to influence directly in that frame. A lot of what we do actually is outside of that, campaigning globally very much as an outsider. I'll talk a little bit more about the work that we've done in suing the U.S. government, in particular on some key issues. And of course, we support gender justice in all areas of work and try to look at the differentiated impacts, gender impacts of extractive industries on the communities where we're working. A key couple of pillars of our work are human rights and free, prior, and informed consent. And that's that FPIC acronym up there. We're trying to ensure that human rights are upheld and livelihoods are protected in the communities where we're working. I mentioned some of those negative impacts as well. Those are particularly problematic in countries where there already is conflict or where there's poor governance. People talk about the resource curse. Inequalities tend to be exacerbated when there's this sudden arrival of a huge potential wealth as a result of extractive industries. And promoting, again, the free, prior, and informed consent of communities. I think that there's a slide about that. No, there's not. Okay, so free, prior, and informed consent is basically trying to address that issue of the information imbalance that happens between communities and companies and governments. This was a stunt that we did outside of the SEC in Washington. Transparency is not monkey business, and targeting Chevron, ExxonMobil, someone whose name I can't read very well. Transparency and accountability are another two pillars of our work. So increasing public disclosure of the payments that are being made by oil and mining companies to governments, as well as contractual and other financial information, is a way of promoting this greater accountability for the use of revenues. And of course, companies are very, very reluctant to release any of this information. They say it compromises their competitiveness in the workforce, and vis-a-vis other actors and their competitors. But when you start looking into these disclosures, you see absolutely enormous payments being made. We've been promoting disclosure requirements in the U.S. and Europe and in Australian legislation. I'll talk a little bit more about that as I proceed. And we're also working to monitor implementation of contracts, tax collection, and a really massive issue, again, is avoidance of taxes. And this has a really big role in finding alternatives to support countries so that they're more dependent on, less dependent on foreign aid and can actually have tax bases locally that they can use to support their own development. And that's really about this issue of fair domestic resource mobilization. So our theory of change is that those pillars I mentioned, transparency and the sort of citizen voice through free, prior, and informed consent, will lead to increased government accountability, which will lead in conjunction with more extractive revenues invested in affected communities into improved public health and other social goods. This is just a little map of where we're actually working on extractive industries. The green are current countries where we're involved, and the purple ones are one that we're in the earlier stages of working. Again, you'll see some of them are conflict-affected countries, some of them are more peaceful countries, but there's a pretty wide spread, and I think this is a program that's fortunately had a lot of growth within Oxfam as more and more countries are experiencing these challenges of managing the impacts of extractive industry in their countries. So the first case study I want to talk about is in Peru. There's a community called La Arroya, which has been home for a long time to a lead smelter operated by a corporation called Doe Run Peru. La Arroya has been considered one of the most contaminated cities in the world. There was a 2005 study by the University of St. Louis, which revealed just absolutely shocking levels of pollution, of contamination, and really negative health impacts, particularly for children. More than 90% of the children in the town had excessive levels of lead in their bodies. There was also high levels of cadmium, arsenic, sulfur dioxide, and other heavy metals found in children. I don't have a map of it, but La Arroya has sort of two sections, and the old part of the community is really directly across from that smelter that you see in the background there, and there's huge amount of runoff and contamination in the river that separates the two of them. Still a bit of background on Doe Run. This is a metal refining company that's part of a U.S. company called Renco Group, purchased this smelter that's been there for many years in this small mountain town of La Arroya, Peru. At the time of the purchase, Doe Run Peru agreed to improve the facility because there already were a number of environmental and health concerns. But instead, the company allowed toxic elements used in the smelting process to even further contaminate air, water, and soil in the town. And as I mentioned, the huge impact in terms of the health problems that were affecting local children. And of course, I think there was a little bit of investment by the company in health projects in the community, but you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars, as opposed to the hundreds of millions of profit they were getting. Renko is a billion-dollar corporation. In 2009, Doran Peru closed the smelter because of the high cost of complying with cleanup after the government of Peru cited the company for its environmental violations after a really huge campaign by community groups and others supporting outside, including Oxfam. But Renko Group, the U.S. parent company, filed a lawsuit against Peru in 2011, claiming its actions violated the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. Now, as I mentioned, Renko Group is a multi-billion-dollar corporation which employs lobbyists that did a lot of work in Washington, and of course they began lobbying the U.S. government to support it in its case. So a little bit more about the campaign that we actually did. This is Rosa Amaro. She's one of the local activists in the community. It's worth noting that a lot of the activists, people who fought against the company's practices, have received death threats, have really been targeted as a result of their work, and it's been a very dangerous situation for them. We've been working there since 2000, and this particular campaign that I'm talking about now started in 2012 as Doran Peru tried to reopen the smelter that had been closed. So the working with local groups, the campaign sought to stop that complex from being reopened until Doran Peru complied with its environmental commitments. Now, Peru actually has a really interesting system called the PAMA, which is a document that companies have to sign about the environmental impacts of their work. And what we saw was that Doran Peru was violating its PAMA. And already this is a standard. This is a standard that had been created by the government of Peru with all the lobbying by various companies from the outset. And even at that very low threshold of a standard, the company was violating those standards. So what's actually happened? So the campaign sought to influence Peruvian public opinion, which was incredibly important, as well as international public opinion, again, insofar as the company or the parent company is U.S.-based, and there's a lot of international interest as well, trying to put pressure on the executive and the legislative branches in the Peruvian government. So as a result, the Peruvian government fortunately rejected Doran's proposed restructuring plan, and at the moment, Doran is trying to sell the smelter, which it hasn't been able to operate. There's apparently, I checked this week, on a mining website, which is password only unless you're a mining company and can afford to buy access to it. But basically, in the little summary, it said there's only one company which is interested in buying it, and it doesn't look like it's probably going to go through at the moment. The real concern is what is going to be the longer-term impacts on the health of the people in the community. That's very much unclear. What are the responsibilities of Doran Peru for the damage that's been caused for the time the smelter has been operating? What are going to be the solutions for people in the community in terms of jobs that are lost once the company just pulls out? And it raises some really interesting and important questions about campaigning on this in this area, given that companies have this ability to just basically run away. In the U.S., however, and there's an interesting counterpoint, in a town called Herculaneum, Missouri, the U.S.-based branch of Doran was operating a very similar lead smelter. There were millions of dollars of environmental fines, really a huge number of lawsuits that the company fought and eventually lost, many of which actually set stricter standards for lead pollution. Doran closed the smelter last year, and they're in the midst of transitioning the former site. On their website, in their corporate social responsibility section, which is very thin, they talk about what they're doing to try to clean up some of the environmental impact and invest back in the community. That's not something that they're doing in Peru. So the second case study I'll talk about is Ghana. Interestingly, Ghana is a very interesting context, I think, because it's experienced gold mining for really decades. Original name of Ghana was Gold Coast. So years of gold mining has caused serious damage to the health of farming communities and to the environment. There was a major offshore oil discovery in 2007, which I've listed twice for some reason, apologies, and just really know that it was 2007, don't forget. It received finance from the World Bank through the IFC. In 2010, in December, production started, oil production. It's now estimated that oil exports from Ghana will generate over $1 billion per year in revenue for the government for the next 20 years. So a really massive, massive opportunity for a country like Ghana. And a couple of years ago in 2011, as a result of this oil discovery and the beginning of production, Ghana's GDP growth rate was second in the world, 14%. And remember, this is at a time when other countries were having negative GDP growth. So really, really massive, and really massive disincentives to any sort of constraints on the ability of some of the international oil companies to operate. So what did we do? We worked with a number of our partner organizations, and we found a really positive potential environment there. Ghana has a relatively well-organized civil society and a relatively free public discourse. There was a lot of experience already in Ghanaian civil society in terms of the gold mining sector. Back in 2007, we had our first workshop on oil revenue and on contracts, working with local groups to share some of this global knowledge, as I talked about the other countries where we're working. In 2009, we were part of a group of NGOs that supported an agenda-setting report, which I'll talk about in a minute, on the role of oil production in Ghana. In 2010, we supported the establishment of a civil society platform on oil and gas in Ghana. At the moment, we're currently funding oil advocacy officer posts at three different Ghanaian civil society organizations, and we're also supporting various social movements outside of the sort of traditional NGOs, including trade unions and churches, and there's a little logo of the Trade Unions Congress of Ghana, which is one of our partners. So we did lots of campaigning in the year since 2007, and particularly since 2010. Here's a couple of news snippets. There was quite a lot of media pressure. That was a really important tactic in the work that we did. We were able to get our hands on a copy of the draft law, and that was leaked. After it was leaked and appeared in the media, the Ministry of Finance was actually pressured to post a later draft on its website, and so to be more transparent in this process. Prior to the leaking of the bill, it was a really closed-door process without any involvement from civil society. There's also really strong technical analysis. If you look at some of these agreements, they're in hundreds and hundreds of pages, very technical, very specific, and really arcane language. And so being able to hire the right people and get them in the right positions to really analyze this information and get it out there and in a way that would be understandable was really important. There's also a lot of lobbying engagement by Ghanaian groups, really from a broad spectrum of civil society, with their parliament and with the executive branch of government. And we engaged with lots of different campaigning tools, including press conferences, holding forums, doing dialogues, really trying to talk about this issue and make it an issue for public discussion and not something that would just happen behind closed doors in the Capitol. This is another report, actually, that followed up to the 2009 report I mentioned, produced by the African Center for Energy Policy. And this examined oil revenue spending in 2011 to 2013, once there started being this transparency. Prior to that, the Ghanaian government wasn't revealing how it was spending the money it was getting from oil. So a couple of the key findings. First was that social spending was not at all adequately prioritized from oil revenue. For example, the Office of the President itself received 15% of oil revenues, which was more than the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education combined. So very, very unbalanced expenditure law. Nearly half of all oil revenues went to the state oil company, the GNPC. GNPC has spent a lot of money doing things like sponsoring the Ghanaian national football team, the Black Stars, and really throwing its money around and doing lots of sponsorships, building its image and profile. But again, not money that was going to development. There's also another really interesting key finding, I think, which is that there was in a desire to sort of promote equity, there was this spreading of resources across the entire country. So the actual quality and efficiency of expenditure was massively reduced because there wasn't any assessment of the needs in various areas or in particular sectors, but rather a sort of desire to spread equally the resources across the country, which led to very few projects actually being completed given the small amount of funds that were actually devoted. So as a result, the Oil for Food campaign was launched in September of last year, to try to get the government to devote more resources to agriculture, in particular in the 2014 budget. The decision to focus on agriculture was based on a lot of these multi-stakeholder dialogues and public forums to discuss what areas really should be prioritized. A little bit more about that campaign. Again, the objective was to pressure the government to devote more of its oil revenues to agriculture, to promote food security and improve public health. Lots of different tactics were used, radio discussions. There were actually radio messages and discussions held in every part of the country and by all the different radio stations in every single district. We blasted SMSs to about 100,000 citizens across the country. As a result, 20,000 signatures were gathered, and 100 farmers marched to Parliament to present a petition with those signatures. And that's a little box for petitions there. The result was that Ghana decided to devote 15% of its oil revenues in its 2014 budget to agriculture modernization, and 94.5, so almost all of that, was focused on initiatives that alleviate poverty for small-scale farmers. So really looking at where such a large number of people are employed. That's it. Thanks very much.
So we promised to hold your interest, and I think they exceeded that expectation for sure. Thank you, guys. We'll open it up to any questions that you might have for either presenter at this point.
Essentially, no. The question is there any difference between genetically engineered and genetically modified as I use the terms? No.
And then the second question has to do with the discussion you had about some African countries that rejected those genetically modified foods, like Zambia, Zimbabwe, and so on. I know that the president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, was quoted as saying it's better for his people to starve than to accept those foods. I guess my question for you is, I want to play the devil's advocate now. Do you think it's better to let the people starve than take that food off? If you look at the flip side, malaria kills, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every year in Africa, you know. So I'm just trying to see what's your perspective on that.
Well, no, of course I don't think it's better to let people starve than to take any sort of food aid. I mean, even if it means taking rotten food or something like that, that could be somewhat salvaged. But what was going on at the same time is that all these other countries had come and said, we will give you food aid. But there was tremendous, tremendous pressure brought. I mean, one person who's been sort of at the forefront of this has been Hillary Clinton, too. And it was a potential presidential candidate. So I suppose on a lesser than two evil scales, and I wouldn't have put it as Mugabe did. I think what Mugabe and I've absolutely, you know, Mugabe's a totalitarian, evil, human rights abusing scumbag. But I think what he may have been trying to say is that this could cost our economy greatly and lead to much greater degrees of famine than we already have, because no economy, no country, no food, which of course means no office for Mugabe. I'd also just like to mention while I'm up here is on my website there is a page devoted to gold, diamonds, and cut flowers, and a slideshow as well as a piece from Health and Human Rights looking at the health, the women's rights, the environmental, the financial issues that are consequent to what you could think of as the symbols of love, gold, diamond, and cut flowers, and it goes over all of that, and it's a pretty depressing piece. It's obviously no one, you know, I'm not married, but I don't wear a wedding ring, and I think maybe that explains my dating slump, is that people read that and say, well, I'm not going to get a ring or even potentially flowers, but it might open your eyes to alternative gifts that it can express your love without having tremendous human rights consequences.
No, I'm sorry, I can't remember the other. in that community?
We've been encouraged to repeat questions. I think everyone heard that, but for the recording process. So the question was about new Canadian policies of tying more directly aid to mining and other interests. I wasn't aware of that very specific aspect of it. I think there's definitely been a really worrying trend in the way that the Canadians in particular have been directing their aid that probably is tied to the current government in Canada. But that's exactly the kind of project that's particularly concerning. You know, obviously there is a need for assistance in communities that are affected by by extractive industries. But I think what you know what you've outlined in terms of linking an NGO project with a Rio Tinto type extractive project is exactly the wrong way to do things, and it really runs contrary to what we're talking about in terms of community-led and community ownership of development projects. Having those decisions made in Ottawa as opposed to in the community is really everything that we're fighting against. Thanks.
Are there any other questions?
Well, I'll ask a question.
I really liked your talk, and it's the classic story of internalization of profits and externalization of costs. And I'm wondering, I can't remember, I'm having a brain freeze on the law right now that allows companies that commit human rights abuses overseas but are based in the United States to be sued in American courts. And is anything happening on that front or in the courts locally in Peru to get them to cover the health costs, environmental costs, and what's happening in terms of that U.S. law, if you know anything about that?
That's a really good question. I don't have that information. I could definitely find out. I think there's a real concern, I think, that as the Dole Run Peru operations are scaling back, there is a decline in interest, particularly at the international level. Groups tend to move on and try to fight other cases, other causes. And I think that's why I'm particularly concerned about what's actually happening in those communities. What I can say is that there's an organization in Peru called VIDA, which is continuing to work at the very community level, but I'm not sure if they have established the connections with more of the international groups to see what kinds of lawsuits might be possible. Again, given that Renko, I was just again on their website, they're one of the largest companies in the world. They're billions and billions and billions in resources. So I think that any lawsuit would be probably very difficult, particularly given that they were complaining about the sort of causation issues, particularly given that they purchased a smelter that was already operational at the time they purchased it. But it's absolutely something that would be interesting to pursue and really important in terms of providing some sort of remedy for the people who have been affected. Interestingly, I actually gave a talk yesterday about the private sector work that Oxfam does. And we do a lot of work. We have a private sector team that does actually a lot of work with our extractive industry team, looking at corporate responsibility for human rights. And according to the UN human rights guidelines for business and human rights, the sort of three pillars. The first pillar is the state obligation to protect human rights. The second pillar is a corporate responsibility to respect human rights. And the third pillar is for it to be an access to remedy. I think in this case, the Dole Run Peru certainly would meet the would be the very case that require that reaches this threshold, but I haven't heard anything about any remedy. So a real concern again from in that community about the lack of access to remedy or any accountability from the company. If you compare that with the smelter in Missouri, where there's been a huge amount of lawsuits and the company has been forced to take action, there's a real gap in terms of measures to remedy the harms that have been done.
I just remembered I neglected to say anything about biofarming, and I said I would say something briefly, so I'll just give you two sentences. Biofarming is the genetic modification of crops to produce pharmaceuticals and industrial chemicals. So the concept is you genetically engineer corn to, say, produce a blood thinner or a contraceptive or a chemotherapy agent or an abortifacient or whatnot, and basically you're eliminating the manufacturing plant because the manufacturing plant is the field, and I'm going to oversimplify, but the plants produce that particular pharmaceutical or industrial chemical, you grind them up, you extract it, and voila, there's your drug. And so you can imagine the consequences if these plants invade neighboring fields and expose us unwittingly to pharmaceuticals above and beyond what we might get in the water supply or from our doctors.
Okay, now there are a lot of hands that just popped up, so why don't we start over here?
The only way you can really know if you're eating non-GM foodstuffs, be they processed food or actual corn, is if it says organic or non-GMO on the label, and that's a voluntary label. There are organic standards, so it's also a voluntary label, but you have to meet certain standards. Non-GMO, again, you also have to have less than 0.9% of genetically modified foodstuffs, and so people who grow those crops want that label on it, but almost all the corn grown in the U.S. is genetically modified. So if you're just buying corn at the supermarket, then you're getting GM corn.
Thanks very much. Just to repeat that, she was saying nice things about Oxfam, so thanks for that. I don't actually know. I can find out if you want to chat afterwards. I can give you my card and put you in contact with some of my colleagues who run the Extractive Industries program within Oxfam. I know that we tend to work, unfortunately, in countries for a really long time, particularly conflict-affected countries. Us being there is not necessarily a great sign. We've actually reduced the number of countries we worked in the last few years. But unfortunately, we are still working in a lot of contexts because there's still need. What that does, though, is give us the opportunity to look longer term at some of these issues. And I think I remember the institute you mentioned was part of. They've definitely done a lot of work on in the La Arroya case. I remember coming on that, across that on their website. But I don't know what work we're doing with them now. But again, I'll hand you my card and we can talk more afterwards.
Yeah, the Green Revolution, which has been much lauded, is really an offshoot of the development of pesticides, starting back with the Haber process, Fritz Haber in Germany, and we're essentially, through herbicides and pesticides, eating the products, as Vandana Shiva has said, eating the products of chemical warfare. The Green Revolution was this revolution to, get rid of pests and improve yields and so on. And so this is sort of the next step. That was the step of corporate control of agriculture through production and distribution of pesticides. And in part, the whole topic of the Green Revolution is much deeper, but this is kind of the next step, is now we can control the seeds. What's coming next is hard to say. The they are now genetically modifying vertebrates to basically turn goats and sheep and cows and other animals into factories that produce, through their milk, pharmaceuticals. And so who knows what scary things are next.
Was there one other hand? Okay, well, thank you all for attending. This both presentations were fascinating. I'm sure you've learned just as much as I have. And it's really important to think about these issues on a global scale. As both presenters pointed out, you know, these issues impact social justice. And when we think about issues surrounding social justice, we often think very centered on one topic or globally or locally, whereas it's very important to look at the whole picture. Both presenters pointed out that these things impact us on our day-to-day lives and on a global scale. So I just want to thank them for putting a lot of work into these thoughtful presentations, and thank you all for attending.